Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, here on Heritage Radio Network. And today the question at hand is, which came first, the cookie or the chocolate chip? Well, we're going to explore that question today, and I have just the person to answer it. You know, there are only a few truly iconic American food items, and two of the most well-known, of course, we have to not include Coca-Cola. That's the third well-known. That's another show, by the way. We've done that one. But the two really well-known iconic American food items are Spam and the Toll House chocolate chip cookie. I would venture to say that probably the first, and for many of us, the only homemade cookie you've ever eaten has been a Toll House chocolate chip cookie fresh out of the oven. Who can resist that? And it's interesting because both of these items, they have a very interesting history, and they both were born around the same time in the same era. This year marks the 75th anniversary of America's favorite cookie, and Spam is well into its 77th year. Well, my guest today, who can answer all those questions, is no stranger to these American pop culture iconic foods, if you will. She is the ultimate authority on American popular foods, Carolyn Wyman. And Carolyn has authored several books on these topics. She has just released The Great American Chocolate Chip Cookie Book, which we will talk about in length today. And her previous books are Spam, a biography, Jell-O, a biography. Ooh, didn't know Jell-O was that iconic thing, did you? And Better Than Homemade, as well as the Great Philly Cheesesteak Book. That was a mouthful. I couldn't get that out. Carolyn, what food are you going to explore next?
That's a good question. I'm open for suggestions. Yeah, I'm running out of icons, aren't I?
I guess. Well, welcome to the show. I have to tell you, reading the book has been a real pleasure because there are so many, aside from writing the history, there are so many wonderful side stories to this chocolate chip cookie story. All right, so let's answer that question first before we hold people in suspense too long. Which came first, the cookie or the chip?
The cookie. And, that's something I think is really interesting. You know, maybe you know this. I don't, but how many, food products have been invented for use in a specific recipe. I can't think of another one except for, I know that Kraft Caramels, for a while, they came out with a cut-up version of the caramel to use in the popular recipes.
Yeah, well, even the individual caramels were used specifically for caramel apples. Man, they would write that recipe on the package, but those taffy apples existed long before the caramels.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
You're right. I think that's a tough call.
That's another thing that makes it interesting is that this recipe was so popular that a major food company at the time decided, hey, we got to make this easier for people instead of making them chop up, candy bars,
right,
which is how it started.
Well, let's give our listeners the background of the history. I think a lot of people aren't aware of some of the myths that surround the history. Everyone reads the story on the package of the Nestle Toll House chocolate chips, and that's what we're talking about, Nestle here, and that's an interesting story in itself that it's Nestle and not somebody else. So give us a little run through of the history of the chocolate chip cookie.
Well, yeah, I think a lot of people, they buy the morsels, the Nestle morsels, and they see the Toll House logo there, But if you look at it closely, there's a building there, and so there was a toll house, and it was a restaurant. A lot of people outside of New England maybe don't know this or never went there. My parents actually, I mean, I grew up about 40 miles from the toll house, so my parents certainly went there. My, you know, my relatives all went there because it was a very well-known, high-end restaurant. And in the 30s, you know, there weren't that many restaurants, and the ones that succeeded tended to be very, you know, to do very well and be very big. And they started out with just, you know, a single room, this Toll House restaurant in 1930, and they kept adding on additions because it was so successful. And it was owned by Ruth and Ken Wakefield, and Ruth was a very... I got the impression from everyone I talked to, including her daughter, you know, she was a very good businesswoman, and she was sort of the lead, I think, on that restaurant. And,
she was a tough cookie, that's what you wanted to say.
Yes, that's a good way of putting it. And she was constantly working on her business and making it better. It was just served classic New England foods, impeccable service. You know, I talked to some former waitresses who worked for her and said, you know, they didn't work for 3 months. They trained for 3 months before they would get the full 2 tables a night. I mean, this was, you know, to us wasn't like gourmet food, but it was very good food, classic, you know, lobster. And she was famous for her desserts and fancy desserts, you know, Indian pudding and rum cake.
And she was, and it seems to me she was making that Mile High lemon meringue pie before anyone even coined the name Mile High lemon meringue pie.
Yeah, apparently. I mean, that's one of the former busboys told me, you know, walking around, the waitress would be walking around with these slices of pie, and it was like sailboats, you know, going through the room because it had a big white puff on the top.
And her Indian pudding, in fact, was very famous. You know, something I learned from your book that I had not been aware of is that Duncan Hines, aside from the fact that he was a real man, that he was a food critic before he went into the packaging industry.
Yeah, he was America's probably first most famous national food critic. And he traveled all around and, you know, started out, he was a traveling salesman. That's another whole story, and there's actually been a book written about him. But a traveling salesman, and he used to write to his friends about his favorite places that he ate around the country, and then eventually, you know, became a food critic. But he said, yeah, her Indian pudding was like, he put it on his top, you know, list of foods in America, I think top 10 list of dishes in American restaurants in 1947, like, you know, one of the best dishes. And Julia Child visited this restaurant. All the celebrity, any celebrity who traveled to Boston went to that restaurant. And for locals, you know, because Whitman, where it was, south of Boston, was sort of a shoe factory town. So for local people, it seemed like it was a special occasion restaurant. And it was also a place where it was like, you know, endless supplies of seconds, you know, if you wanted more, that was on the house.
Wow.
So she had these fabulous desserts, but she had ice cream, like any, you know, at the time you would have ice cream as part of the dessert menu, and she served little some cookies on the side of the dish of ice cream, which again is kind of, I remember that when I was a kid, that if you went to a restaurant, that would be kind of a standard, sort of a giveaway.
Right. They would either be stuck in the top of the ice cream as a decoration, or they'd be on the side on the plate, right?
With right. And originally, it was a butterscotch cookie that she served there. And again, she in January, the restaurant closed. She actually paid all her employees to have that month off because they worked really hard the rest of the year. And she went on, she traveled and, you know, usually overseas, and, you know, tasted a lot of foods, bought different things for her restaurant, you know, because it was decorated very with colonial and kind of a very eclectic decor. I mean, she cared about everything in the restaurant. And it sort of was a time to regroup and refresh and come up with new ideas. And after a trip to Egypt, it was interesting, you think about this American iconic kind of very straightforward food was invented by a woman that had just come back from Egypt. And she got this idea of putting chocolate in this cookie. And she had gone to, you know, to college for household arts. She had some kind of, you know, experiments, apparently, a class where they experimented with using chocolate in desserts. And there's a lot of myths about, you know, how the cookie was invented. And I think a lot of it has to do with partly sexism, probably, and also with sort of America's or everybody's love of the idea of, you know, you can just stumble on a great idea, you know, you can win the lotto, you don't have to do any work, and it's all going to come easy.
She was too methodical a person for that. Right?
Yeah, I mean, she ran her restaurant, you know, like sounded like an army almost. Right. And
it's interesting to note that some of the myths are really fun stories too. Like one, you tell us a couple of the biggest myths.
Well, I mean, if you go on the internet, you know, you're going to see it's basically, oh, the chocolate chip cookie was invented and it was an accident, you know, and it's a great story of how she ran, the most popular version is she ran out of nuts for this cookie that she was serving at the restaurant, and she had some chocolate on hand. She decided to add it. But there's all sorts of variations about, you know, well, she thought it was going to melt. She was really trying to make a chocolate-flavored cookie. And at that time, that was really how chocolate was used in dessert making. It was almost always melted.
Right. It was no stranger to the baking process, certainly.
Right. And there's, you know, other one story was, you know, she ran out of butter, and she thought that the cocoa butter in the chocolate would substitute. Another one says that she got a gift from Andrew Nestle and of a chocolate bar, and she decided to use it when she ran out. I mean, and it's like there was no Andrew Nestle. I mean, it was this, and they had sold the company years before. So I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of things that aren't true. And I mean, however it starts, you know how the old story about the, you know, you whisper something to someone and it gets to the end of the circle and it's a whole different story. Right. I mean,
well, I love the story about,
in some ways, I don't know how it started, but you can't blame people for repeating that story because there really was very little available when I went into this, you know, talking to the former employees and even her daughter. I mean, most of them really didn't know, and it was only after, finally, after doing archival-type research, like newspaper clippings, that I found two newspaper clippings and a speech she gave in the 30s where she talked about inventing the chocolate chip cookie. And that was like, you can imagine that was a very happy day for this researcher.
So indeed, we should paste a date on it for our listeners. And we're talking, what, 1938.
1938, yeah. And she, you know, Nestle always talks about the anniversary of the chocolate chip because that, you know, is what they invented, and that's their 75th anniversary is this year. Because, you know, basically what happened was she had made it initially from, she used a chocolate bar. Nestle made a semi-sweet chocolate bar. And when she got this, the day she decided to try this new variation on her cookie, she went to her wholesaler, and the wholesaler was out of her usual brand, which was actually Baker's brand, which is still made today. It's now owned by Kraft, but it was based in Massachusetts, right near her, so it makes sense. But again, this was from another interview where she told someone this, and they were out, so she said, "Well, I'll take the Nestle," and the Nestle worked, and she saw no reason to change. It was popular, and And so basically there's kind of this little sleepy selling candy bar. Suddenly, Nestle executives started seeing all these, the sales go up in that area. And because she, people liked the cookie, and she was giving away the recipe. She wrote it up and, you know, mimeographed it and handed it out. And then it got into the Boston Globe, the local papers reprinted it. You know, they had sort of a recipe swap column, and it showed up there very early on in 1938. And then she, you know, Ruth did some local radio, and basically it just sort of got popular.
Well, I mean, the cookie that went around the world, basically. And
yeah.
And Nestle being, you know, no fool, they signed on a deal with her, right?
Right, right. And they approached her, and, you know, that's, nobody likes to talk about what the deal was. Nestle doesn't want to talk about it. Her daughter doesn't want to talk about it. And, I mean, I think there's, one interview, Ruth said she sold it for a dollar, that she sold the rights to the recipe for a dollar. And because, you know, she was a professional woman at the time, they kind of didn't, you know, get down and dirty with negotiating money. But I think, you know, there's no need to cry for her, because she had a really successful, very successful restaurant, and did really well in terms of cross-marketing her restaurant, her cookbook. I think she probably, and there's rumored that she got chocolate for life. I don't know. I wasn't really able to confirm that. But she certainly got a lot of publicity out of it. You know, when we talk about today, we talk about cross-marketing, and, you know, I mean, she was a genius at that before that term had even been invented, because, you know, Nestle, every time they ran an ad in the early days, they said, from the famous Toll House restaurant in Whitman, Mass. And they said, she, even before inventing the chocolate chip cookie, had a cookbook that was reprinted every year for years, and was a bestseller.
Right. And we're going to talk more about that cookbook and about the Toll House brand and things that came along after that when we come back after a short break. So stay tuned.
Every night you hear crooning of a Russian lullaby. Just a plaintive little tune when baby starts to cry. Rock-a-bye, my baby. Somewhere there may be a land that's free for you and me and a Russian lullaby.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years. So it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
This is Russian Lullaby by Plexophonic on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Baby starts to cry. Rock goodbye, my baby.
Hi, we are back, and I am talking with Carolyn Wyman, who has recently written a book called The Great American Chocolate Chip Cookie Book. Guess what we're talking about? You bet. Chocolate chip cookies and the Nestle Toll House chocolate chips. You know, Carolyn, you wrote about this in your book, and I think it's interesting for us to mention on the air as well, is that there is a tie with real American history, the fact that this is an American icon, the chocolate chip cookie. There is a tie with American history, and that being Amelia Simmons's cookbook from 1795, which was the first cookbook purported to be published in America. And there was a recipe for a cookie that some attributed to maybe one of the original types of wafers that she served, the drop dew cookie. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Again, when I was trying to, you know, discover, did Ruth Wakefield really invent the drop dew cookie and how, you know, I read a lot about there was a connection being made by Nestle between Ruth Wakefield's chocolate chip cookie and the drop dew cookie, which is, I guess, one of two cookie recipes in that American cookery cookbook. But I didn't really understand it, because if you look at that drop dew recipe, I mean, it has no brown sugar, which is really a distinguishing thing about the chocolate chip. It also has, like, mace and it just didn't make sense to me that mm-hmm. it didn't sound like the chocolate cookie at all. And I was able to, you know, Nestle let me look at some of their archives, and there's a particular brochure that they put out in 1960 where a copywriter kind of fancifully, he's sort of talking about how, or she, I'm not sure, you know, the Toll House supposedly had colonial origins, so he's sort of kind of fancifully linking the colonial Toll House cookie, or the colonial Toll House restaurant, with this iconic cookie. And it just was basically, the language was something like, you know, therefore, the drop dew is probably the earliest ancestor of the Toll House cookie. It says probably, right? In the Toll House cookie, the spirit of colonial time shines through. Like the drop dew, it still stands for hospitality, kindness, for the good things in life. So it was just a throw off, very fanciful line. But later people who read this didn't pick up on the kind of subtlety of that, and basically said, "Oh, it's the descendant of the drop dew."
Another myth, right?
Yeah,
but
yeah,
well, interestingly enough, I mean, I guess even though yes, there are the differences in the no brown sugar and the use of mace, which at that in 1795 would have been common, but a sweet wafer nonetheless, crisp wafer, as opposed to cookies, which were more like hard cakes prior to that. So mm-hmm. I can see where people would want to relate the two. But anyway, it is certainly an American icon today. And it just persisted so much in America's diets and desires that, of course, wartime, with so many of these products that became icons, the wars and World War II, in this case, certainly helped promote its popularity.
Right, and you mentioned, you know, Coca-Cola before, and like Coca-Cola, you know, people sent, you know, homemade chocolate chip cookies to soldiers overseas. They would share them with their buddies, and so what started out is really more of an East Coast, New England, and then East Coast phenomena, really, that helped it to become known all over the country.
Then it became nationwide the most popular cookie, so much so that a lot of other people tried to get rich and did off of making their own brands, right?
Right, right. And, you know, basically, as I said, you know, for Ruth, and even today, I mean, you know, cookies are not on the dessert menu of too many restaurants. It's more of a home food, and that's what it was for her. I mean, she gave out the recipe. People made it at home, and people really didn't go to the Toll House, you know, for the cookies, at least not until the very end when they did start putting them on the menu before it she sold it. But other people, you know, times changed, and, you know, people in the 60s, 70s, it was more, people weren't baking as much. And, you know, as some of us remember, in the 80s, there were, you know, a number of very high-profile, successful, at least for a while, you know, chocolate chip cookie chains, Famous Amos, Mrs. Fields, and David's.
David's
was more an East Coast.
Indeed, you know, it was all about this very simple kind of home, as you say, homemade kind of taste. Homemade, but you know, I was in reading the book. I was very interested to find out that the Well, the first package mix came out as early as it did by Nabisco, the Chips Ahoy.
Mm-hmm.
That was earlier than I would have thought. When they came out, oh, when did they come out? In the 50s?
I believe it was early 60s.
Early 60s,
yeah.
Right. And then the cookie, there was a cookie mix. I mean, we all know that refrigerated cookie dough came out, you know, and that was kind of a revelation for a lot of people. They couldn't even mix up the mix. They just grabbed the dough off the shelf and slice and bake, right?
Right.
But that there was a chocolate chip cookie mix, that I wasn't aware of, a dry mix.
Yeah, and in fact, Nestle did one pretty early on as well. Yeah, I mean, you know, part of the whole convenience craze, you know, post-war convenience food craze of that time, the 50s, the early 60s. And so in a way, you know, the bringing it to these little shops, the cookie stores, that was more of a gourmetization, I guess, of it. And what's interesting to me is that the cookie over history has just kind of gone back and forth. You know, it's like, you know, this kind of high, started out at this high-end restaurant, then became Chips Ahoy in the 60s, you know, kind of a common thing. Then these cookie stores that made these high-end expensive, for the time, you know, gourmet-type cookies. And then when that trend sort of, you know, burnt out, it was partly because one of these cookie chains, Otis Spunkmeyer, which was based in California, it started out as a cookie chain, a competitor to Famous Amos and Mrs. Fields. They kind of saw the beginning of the end of that fad of cookie shops, and they came up with this idea of selling the cookie dough with a little confection oven to other businesses, and really made this new wave of kind of, in some ways, where we are now of chocolate chip fresh, you know, fresh baked, I don't know how high end you want to say they are, but fresh baked chocolate chip cookies, ubiquitous, you know, being everywhere, like right. At McDonald's and Subway, they're the ones that supplied those big other chains, yeah, with
big tubs of dough and the instructions, so it's sort of industrialized homemade, right?
Right. And then, you know, and then like in the 2000s, 2008, we have this kind of backlash again against, oh, well, this is kind of an industrial cookie, and you got the New York Times, you know, putting that the perfect chocolate chip recipe out. It was a huge, you know, phenom on the web, the New York Times chocolate chip cookie recipe, very fussy recipe with, you know, put special salt on it, to use these, you know, confectioner's chocolate pieces or cut up your own, and Cook's Illustrated followed, and it's just, you know, it goes back and forth between what it's going to be. Is it right. going to be something you buy in the store, kind of, or is it going to be something you make
right.
at home?
Basic homemade in my family, and it's no nuts, I tell you. And everybody has to admit that they love, or have, if they don't love it, they have eaten the dough before it's baked. I mean, the dough, it tastes so good. Who cannot eat that, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of the latest thing, which is, you know, don't even knead it, you know, like just don't even bake it. Just eat it right the way it is.
Yeah, and there's, that spawned an industry in itself. And, you know, we were talking about the war and how the war created such popularity with certain brands, Coca-Cola, the chocolate chip cookie. Another one that is, I'm sure, very near and dear to your heart, and that is Spam. Spam was created, what, 1937?
1937, yes, just about the same time as right. the chocolate chip cookie.
By the Hormel company. And why? Why did they create it?
It was basically a way to sell this kind of piece of meat that they weren't making any money on. They were basically throwing it out. It was pork shoulder. And it was not a bad piece of meat, but it was really difficult. They had to cut it off in a way that, you know, took time. And it ended up in these little pieces. And so they basically, Jay Hormel got this idea to combine it with some ham and make it into this branded product so that, you know, it would be desired. And it also, interestingly, because Hormel had some labor problems later on in their history, but originally one of his goals was to have a product that he would able to keep people working year-round, because at that time it was all, they were selling pork, it was always fresh, and so they would lay people off after the hog-killing season was over. So this was, having a processed product would, you know, have give them something to do in these kind of down times.
Well, talk about a product that went round the world. It is now, I think it's more popular in Korea than any place else right now. They have this newfound love of Spam. Korea and Hawaii and where else?
Philippines,
right. To what do you attribute this popularity?
Well, when I worked on my book, I talked to the guy in charge of international sales for Spam, and he said there's three things that make Spam popular in other parts of the world. And one is current or former U.S. military presence, because Spam has always been, you know, it doesn't spoil, so it's always been sent to the soldiers. A love of pork, a kind of a culture that likes pork, and also extremes in temperature, interestingly enough, because, again, it's not perishable. And so most of these places, you know, it seems weird, oh, it would be popular in Alaska and in Hawaii and in the Philippines, but all those things, those three things apply to all those places. And,
And if any one product, it's interesting, any one product is so incredibly popular, but also there's not one product that is more maligned than Spam.
Yeah. Well, but again, it's like it depends on where you're coming from. And I think, you know, we were talking about before the show about this, you know, New York Times just ran a story about, again, about something that was in my book, too, you know, in South Korea. It's given as gifts. During like the New Year, formal packages of Spam, and it depends on where you're coming from. I mean, you know, in Guam, it's also really popular and prized, and it's because, you know, they have typhoons all the time. I mean, you know, we sit here in our, you know, nice warm houses and can go to our gourmet restaurants, but if you're, you know, not rich and if you have a lot of weather issues, Spam is something, or you have a, just remember when your country was struggling and the Americans came and helped out, you have much fonder feelings for Spam than maybe we do.
I guess so. And, of course, anyone who has watched some of the old Monty Python skits, I mean, you have to laugh at that, where everything everything on the menu was Spam, made with Spam.
Right, right. And that skit, you know, was written by a guy whose parents ate way too much Spam during the Lend-Lease program during World War II. We were helping him out. We were helping to keep the English alive by sending them Spam, but they got, you know, a little sick of it. And so that's why he came up with that skit, like his channeling his parents' feelings.
And hence we have the moniker Spam for any email that we don't particularly want or that gets sent out of control to too many people, right?
Right, right. And again, it's just like the early kids who were on the internet, kind of nerdy kids, loved Monty Python. They remembered that skit, and that's how they came up with Spam.
Yeah. So. You know, it's interesting because as with hot dogs and a few other, you know, processed foods, the urban myth tales that go around, oh, it's made with all the sweepings of the butcher's floor and things like that. Well, Hormel is a company that really couldn't afford to have their reputation slip onto something like that. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, there's like so many worse things to eat. If you're nervous about eating, you know, pig's tongue skins, snouts or whatever, don't come to Philadelphia where I live, because, you know, we got scrapple, and that really does have that stuff in it. But Spam's only pork shoulder and ham, you know, and salt, sugar, sodium nitrite as a preservative. That's it. It's a pretty clean label.
Right. I think that gelatinous glaze kind of probably turns some people off, not liking that texture, but it's pure meat, and it's good. All right. And interesting, the name, people asked about the name. Where did the name Spam come from for the product?
It, Well, it was actually named at a party. Jay Hormel had a party at his house on Chris. I think it was New Year's Eve, and an actor named it. And it's supposed to be from shoulder. Well, there's a couple of theories: shoulder of pork and ham. So you kind of mush that together. Spiced ham is the most what most people say, but I don't believe that. I think shoulder of pork and ham because of the weather, the spices. I mean, I suppose in the Midwest in the 30s, maybe salt and sugar or spices. I don't know. But
well, any way you slice it, it's spam. and I have to thank you so much for being such a digger of information about these American pop cultural icons, because they're things that we tend to put on the back of the shelf like a can of spam and forget about. And they all have such interesting history. So next time you're in the kitchen on a snowy day baking up a batch of chocolate chip cookies, think about where that all started. Carolyn Wyman, thank you so much for sharing your stories. And thank you. And thank you for listening to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.